15 years ago today, the world changed as we know it. As it was mentioned in Pat's reading, anyone who is younger than a high school sophomore may not even remember this day because they weren't born yet. They remember images they saw after the fact that have been burned into our memories. Most of us can remember exactly where we were and what we were doing on this day, September 11th, 2001. I was in college, and I was a college chaplain to my floor, which was like a pastor slash RA to my hall of girls. And like many other college students, I'd been up late the night before studying, I'm sure, and I was sleeping in. And I got awakened to this news that the Twin Towers had fallen and that it was terrorism. And it took me a little while to wrap my brain around it because I was being asked to run down the hall and pray for the girls upon hearing this news. And I wonder about where you were, because I know it's such a huge part of our lives and our memories. And I invite you to call out. Does anybody remember where they were and what they were doing when they heard this? How many of you teachers in here were with a classroom full of children or adults on that day when you found out? Raise your hand. If you were a teacher and you were in the classroom, a lot of people in the first service said they were teaching when they found this out and had to tell their students or find a way to share it with them. Where else? Where were people on that day? If you haven't asked people this question of where they were, it's amazing some of the stories that you'll hear, the people who might have been there but weren't, people who lost others, people who were having to lead a group, like teach in a classroom. There's crazy stories out there, and all of us have our own 9/11 stories, because today, anytime it comes around, we cannot help but remember the terror of watching 4 hijacked planes. We cannot help but remember that over 3,000 people from 90 different countries died that day. And that includes 343 firefighters and 60 police officers who had courage enough to stay rather than run away from these terrible things that were happening. And this was all happening, you all might remember, in a world before everyone had a camera phone or could text or had Facebook. And so what were we all doing to get any information? We were glued to the news, right? We had to watch the news on TV. We didn't know what was going on. And the next day, September 12th, 2001, a major world newspaper called Le Monde had a headline that was so beautiful, and I'm going to butcher it, I'm sure. It said, "Nous sommes tous Américains." Does anyone know what that means? We are all Americans. It means we are all Americans. That was the world newspaper headline the next day in solidarity with what we went through. So the world grieved with us, and they felt for us. And of course, it got really complicated after, because we declared this very violent war on terror, and some of that empathy faded, and it got very complicated. Life is different here now. Homeland security is a household word. Our FBI budget has nearly tripled. In 2001, I don't know if you knew this, I didn't, there were only 30 or so federal air marshals that were on planes, and only a few years later, that number had jumped to 5,000 after facing this threat. All we have to do is stand in line for hours at the airport to remember how different all of our lives are facing this threat of terrorism. So it's very different. Life is different, but is it safer? With this 15th anniversary of that terrible day, there are many journalists who are asking that question from all kinds of major publications. Are we safer? And their answers are very complicated. And I'm not a political expert, so I'm not here to answer that question for you. I have a different question for you. After everything that we have gone through in response to that day, where are our spirits as a nation? How are we doing spiritually after 9/11? How do we judge such a thing? When I ask you that question, I'm not asking you how often you come to church or even how often you pray. I'm thinking, how has your faith shaped your response to the fear that comes after a day like that? God uses all kinds of things to work on us, to shape us and mold us, like I preached about last week. And sometimes God even uses awful things to shape our faith and shape our lives. And I believe God is using the terrible events and the fallout of 9/11 to transform us as individuals and as a nation. He's not done yet. He's working on us. Now, hear me correctly here. I am not saying that God sent 9/11 as a punishment or caused it to happen directly. We live in a world that is broken and bent by hatred and distrust and division. And 9/11 is one way in which that we crumpled under the weight of all that brokenness. But I would ask you, can God use even that, even 9/11? I would say definitely yes. A few days after the Twin Towers fell, our then President George W. Bush, he stood on the rubble and he yelled down into that wreckage. He said, "I can hear you, I can hear you," to the survivors that they were still getting out. "I can hear you, and the rest of the world hears you, and soon the people who did this will hear us too." That's what he said. And I'm wondering, what is it that the rest of the world has heard from us since 9/11? What is the message that we're sending? What have we become since then? Do we stand alone as an exceptional, exempted nation that thinks we're better than everybody? Or do we stand with those who also seek freedom and safety and peace? Our message to the world as Americans is loud, it's conflicted, and it's unclear. It's very, very complicated. But for all of us sitting here, days like 9/11 are a reminder of one of the fundamental truths of faith that are challenging to every nation, that our first identity, none of us, our first identity is not American. It is Christian. That is our true allegiance. We are lucky enough to have been born or come to a country where there is greater wealth and greater freedom than most people can experience or imagine today. We are blessed to have that experience and live here. But we didn't necessarily earn that. God gave that to us. And I often am struck when I listen to the news and I think about, why did I get to be born here, the person I am, with the family I have, with all that we have? I could just as easily have been born an orphan where people suffer AIDS, or I could be a widow in the slums, or I could be a slave in a place like India where there are thousands upon thousands of slaves still today. I could be any one of those things, and so could you. It is only by the grace of God that we were born into these positions of privilege. So there are these people living in desperate situations, and they could have been us. It's by God's grace that it's not us. And the people in the Bible can relate more to the people in the desperate situations than they can to those who are prosperous, like our country today. Israel was much more like the people who suffer. And the psalm that we read today was written during one of the most desperate and tragic times in all of Israel's history. Because not only were their buildings burnt to the ground, but their entire main cities were completely taken over, and they were taken off into captivity, away from the land that they loved. They lost everything. And the nation who had taken it from them would mock them, saying, "Where is your God now? Sing us the songs of Zion now, after what we've done to you." So songs of Zion were like a national anthem or like a worship song. For them, they were just the one and the same. They were saying, "Sing those songs to us now." It was like evil personified. And their responses to that kind of horror were really raw and uncensored. So in places like that psalm or the Book of Lamentations, you read about how they responded to all of this evil. They responded to it with anger and grief and even hatred. That psalm that we read today, it's a really tough psalm to read, but there's one verse that I left out because the kids were still here. Verse 9 of that psalm says, it follows on the prayer that God would take revenge on the people who did this to them. And it actually says in the Bible, you can look it up, verse 8, verse 9, "Happy shall be they who take your little ones, the children of Babylon, and bash their heads against the rocks." It is brutal. One of the most vivid and awful verses in all of Scripture, but it is there. It's in the Psalms. And we have to remember that just because something like that is in the Bible doesn't mean that God approved it. It's simply a real human being talking for real to God. A human being who had been through very serious trauma. And we have to be very careful that we not judge or sanitize the feelings of those who have been through things that we can only imagine, which all of Israel was a traumatized nation. And besides, those of us who are sitting here today couldn't learn the lesson from that psalm if he had decided to censor himself. And the lesson for us simply is that we can say anything to God in prayer. Now, you've probably heard that before. You can say anything to God, but you may not have thought that it goes that far. You can really say anything to God in prayer. That writer did not act on his terrible feelings. He did not become a vigilante and go off and kill Babylonian children, but he did lay bare his soul before God. He let God see the poison that was in him because of all the hurt and trauma he'd experienced. He let God see that. He didn't say how he wished he felt or how he thought God wanted him to feel. He told him how he really felt, and he let God harness that rage and grief and redeem it, even turn it into a worship song, a psalm. Now I wonder, have we trusted God to do that with our nation's rage and fear and betrayal? Have we given our worst and our most violent hopes for revenge over to God, or have we acted on them, taking the future into our own hands? When we feel afraid and threatened, we tend to blame, we tend to point the finger outward versus looking inward. We try to connect with others by forming a common enemy. And after 9/11, we decided other nations were either for us or against us. They were either enlightened like we are, or they were a part of what we called the axis of evil. So people cheered and toasted when Osama bin Laden, the founder of Al-Qaeda, was killed. Their fear gave way for a moment to some relief when that happened. It felt like progress to them. But did it lead to lasting peace? Are we safer? Did it lead to the peace that we are called to build as God's people? Are we ruled in post-9/11 world by our fear or by our love? I liked what Pat said, but I wonder if it really is true. Has our fear been replaced by hope for something better? Or do we allow it to rule us? Most of us hopefully don't have to think about terrorism or international relations on a daily basis. A lot of you young people out there probably don't go to school every day, I hope, thinking about terrorism. But we're all affected by the atmosphere of this country, which has changed since that day. So again, I'd ask, where are we spiritually? Have we become people who distrust those who look different? Who is it that makes us want to stop and turn the other direction versus stay and talk and get to know? Who is in our comfort zone and who is not? The famous pastor Brian McLaren said that the demonizing of others, blaming and fear, all turn into what he calls a spiritually transmitted disease. When we identify others as beyond redemption, as completely bad, like the terrorists, that evil that we point to in them can infect us. It can make us less than what we were called to be. And we were called to be more than just fearful, blaming people. Jesus calls us to one of the hardest things of all. Instead of pushing away enemies, shunning them, calling them names, hiding from them in fear, Jesus calls us to love our enemies. Have we trusted God to help us with that very, very complicated task? To break the cycle of reaction and distrust and division? Are we able to love our enemies that way, really, truly? Do we even recognize that we have enemies in this world? Those are the people that we avoid, that we would never want to get to know. A beautiful example of truly loving our enemies I found this week is two women named Patty Quigley and Susan Reddick, who both lost their husbands in 9/11 while they were pregnant with their children. So they were heartbroken. But for months afterwards, they got in touch with each other and they finally met. And they met in order to raise funds for hundreds of other widows, not here, but in Afghanistan, who were suffering under the crushing weight of poverty in addition to losing their husbands. And they started this nonprofit called Beyond the 11th that would help these women to start small businesses and to sustain themselves in a world where if you didn't have a man, you could not survive. And they got criticized for being unpatriotic, not focusing on the people here. But they felt moved to reach out to people who shared their common grief as human beings, but who shared it from a very, very different experience of reality. They turned people who were in the axis of evil into productive neighbors. So they truly, truly loved their enemies. Jesus says we're to do this so that we might become children of God. And being a child of God should make a difference. It should be different than how the rest of the world would have us live. Jesus asked us, what do you do more than others? Are we capable of loving people, all people, in a way that the world simply does not or cannot? Dr. Martin Luther King once said in a sermon way down in the deep south of Alabama, he said to his congregation there, I love you. I would rather die than hate you. And Jesus essentially said the same thing to the hateful world on the cross, that despite all of us doing hateful things as human beings, God would rather die than hate us for it. So as we remember 9/11 and all the sacrifices made, let us also remember God's sacrifice to show humanity the love that we are capable of, a love that turns enemies into children of God. Amen.